1045 The Zone, hitting the links with you on a Saturday morning. This is Talking Golf with Virgil Herring on 1045 The Zone.
Good morning. It's time to talk a little golf, and you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 1045 The Zone. Got another great show lined up for us today on the Orca Driving Range. One of the greatest teachers in the world is going to be joining us, Bob Grissett. I'm looking forward to that as we'll talk about the improvements to Rory's swing, what he thinks of Tiger Woods' current action, and was the Riviera event just merely a little blip on his radar screen? As always, Nuge is going to write Monday's headlines on Saturday morning at the 15. But joining us today is mental game coach and author and John Gordon certified trainer, Tammy Matheny. Tammy, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Virgil. I hope you are.
I'm doing fantastic. Well, thank you for taking the time to join us here on Saturday morning.
I'm excited to be here.
Confidence, that elusive thing. It's almost like sticking your hand in a bucket and you pull the water out and slowly but surely it drips through your hands if you don't have the proper fundamentals of building it and maintaining it. Talk to us about the elusive yet ever important confidence.
Well, I believe that confidence is the key to everything. If you have confidence, you're going to have the mental toughness on the golf course, in your life, in your business. And I think it's getting people to realize it's not something you're either born with or without, that it's a skill, just like our physical skills, that if we work at every day to build and maintain, then we're going to have a strong foundation of confidence.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And you started your own company in 2008 called Refuse to Lose Coaching. And I love that title because refusing to lose doesn't mean that you necessarily aren't going to lose some games. It's just a mindset of what it takes to be a champion. It does not necessarily mean that you're guaranteed to win. It just guarantees who shows up to compete. Talk to us about refusing to lose.
Well, Refuse to Lose, the name came when I was a tennis coach at USC Upstate, and that became our mantra. Refuse to lose, refuse to lose. And it is a mindset. Did we lose some? Yes. Am I going to lose with teams or athletes I work with? Yes. But to me, a loser is someone who isn't willing to put themselves on the line or who, after failing, doesn't learn the lesson. So my belief is that we can be a learner or a loser. So I want to refuse to lose, and I want to instill that mindset in those that I work with.
Yeah, and to me, that is one of the more fascinating pieces to mental coaching, which is most people believe that it's kind of like DNA. You're either mentally tough or you're not. But it's a muscle just like any other muscle in which if you practice the processes and the fundamentals of being process-wise strong mentally, it has it's like a domino effect that extrapolates outward into your life in every angle. What are some of the keys for you when it comes to taking, let's say you're getting a 13 to 15-year-old junior golfer who has this belief that he or she wants to take her game to the next level. What are some of the processes you like to go through to help teach them how to build the confidence?
The first step is understanding their self-talk. What are the thoughts that they're having about golf, about themselves, the thoughts that they're having on the golf course, and getting them to understand those and then helping them reprogram, I call it P-square, positive or productive thoughts. I'm not one of these who subscribe to the fact that everything can be positive, because sometimes a shot just is not good. But instead of dwelling on that, how do we then have a productive thought so we can move forward from that? And I have found that once you can change and make new habits of thinking, then we can add more levels of skill. But ultimately, it all goes back down to the self-talk. You know, visualization is a skill that I teach as well. Often, though, I'll have an athlete say, well, I visualized hitting a bad shot, or I visualized the ball going into the water. Well, why are they visualizing that? Because their self-talk is negative or unproductive.
And it's fascinating because in all actuality, the brain's kind of trying to protect you. So it's giving you the heads up that something bad could happen, and it leads to bad thought processes. And it's it's kind of hardwired from like a couple thousand years ago. But at the end of the day, it's learning how to win or learn, not win or lose. Let's just say when you have a really talented player who's prepared and went out and did their best and loses, and they're not obviously not mature enough to understand that that's going to happen, and they take it really hard. How do you take their pain and or shame and or whatever it is that they're suffering from the loss, and teach them how to use it in a positive way instead of dwelling on it and becoming a negative trigger that promotes more negative things in the future?
You have to change their focus. And again, our society has created this mentality, like you just said, that it's either you win or lose. And that is based on a comparison to other people, especially in the sport of golf. You may have played your best round of golf. The score may not show that because maybe the golf course was a little bit harder or weather conditions. But you don't feel as good because it wasn't A, your best score, so you're comparing it to previous scores, or B, you're comparing it to the guy that just had his career round. And so it's changing the focus to what did you do well? And I have a simple exercise. I call it WWWs, what went well, and trying to get them after every round, good or bad, to list the specifics of what they did well. Because ultimately, you're trying to get better. You're not going to win every event, especially in golf. So if we can focus on how did you get better, let's carry that to the next round.
I think that you just mentioned something that is really challenging to get kids to do, actually get anybody to do, but it is essential. And every great does it, is journaling, writing it down. Could you talk to us about the how and the why it is so important to journal your successes?
Well, it's our feedback. If we're not journaling and reading through that periodically, the only feedback that we're getting are the results, the outcomes. But there's so much more that we can learn from that. So in journaling just helps keep things in perspective. What went well, some things you need to work on. I don't believe there's an exact way you need to journal, but I do obviously with clients give ideas. But it's getting them to be able to give themselves unemotional feedback instead of this was good or bad.
Yeah. One of the things that I've learned about you recently as we did a podcast together was that you were not good at writing in the words that you used in your book, The Confident Athlete. You then basically properly journaled all of the things that you've learned in your life about what it takes to be confident. And you used your fear of maybe in your own mind feeling like you were not a good writer to turn yourself into a very good writer and a book that is a very solid but fast read, full of principles, not a lot of fluff, just a lot of solid principles. Talk to us about overcoming fear and use you as an example of facing something that was a daunting task and turning into a big, huge stepping stone in your career.
Well, it's a funny story. In high school, I always made good grades except anything that involved writing. And I would get an F or a D on the writing. My English teacher actually gave me an F on a book report and said that it was too good to be mine. So it just kind of was a self-fulfilling prophecy. I can't write. I can't write. And we all have those self-fulfilling prophecies in some area. And so I kind of hung on to that for a long time. And as I evolved in mental game coaching, clients would say, hey, we need something in writing, or you need to start a blog to grow your business, or write a book. Nope, I don't write. And it was just easy for me to hang on to that fear. And I needed to take a look at myself and everything that, like you mentioned, I did journal. And I thought, well, I'm doing exactly what I asked my clients not to do. So the writing of The Confident Athlete, the initial reason that I wrote it was me letting go of that chain. And I want to be a good role model for the clients that I work with. And we all have those fears. So again, the journaling helped me. Changing my focus and self-talk led me to to then be able to write, like you said, no fluff at all, but simple to the point. Here we go. Work on these skills, and it gives you a greater chance of improving your golf game. And it was probably one of my biggest successes in life, was just writing. It didn't matter the book sales. It didn't matter anything, but just having that book written.
Yeah, just going through the exercise of exercising your mental demons, and you learned a valuable lesson from yourself by standing in the mirror and denying the old ideals. And of all the things that I can share with people out there, as our podcast will come out probably in about 3 weeks, is that's what I learned from you, is that you practice what you preach, which is what we all want in a coach. And I was really blown away by your story, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time to come on. Please share your information about Refuse to Lose, where they can find you, and your book, The Confident Athlete.
Okay, The Confident Athlete is available online at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. My website, www.r2lc.com, and I have a strong presence on Twitter as well, R2L Coaching. And you can reach me by email, Tammy, T-A-M-I, at R2LC.com.
Tammy, thank you so much for coming on. So great to have a chance to spend some time with you this week, and I look forward to having you on again really soon.
Thank you, Virgil. Have a great day.
Excellent. Thank you. When we return, Nuge is going to join us, and we're going to write Monday's headlines, so stick around. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone.
Hey, it's Mickey Ryan.
Welcome back, and you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. If you'd like to get involved with the show, hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Virgil Torspin. It's at this time every Saturday morning. We bring in the founder of Global Golf Post to write Monday's headlines on Saturday morning, Jim Nugent. Nuge, how are you today, buddy?
Good morning, Virgil. Thank you for having me on today.
My pleasure. We've got a lot of things to talk about, some of them on the golf course and some of them not. Let's talk with the things that are on the golf course. A fairly solid leaderboard full of the people we'd like to watch, with Bryson DeChambeau leading Evan Van Rooyen and Patrick Reed at minus 10. He's leading by one over them. DeChambeau is at minus 11, with Matsuyama and Justin Thomas at 9 and Rory at 8. And then a pretty big fall off after that. So a pretty top-heavy leaderboard with some interesting personalities at the top of the leaderboard. What's your take on Bryson DeChambeau, his new body, new game, and same verbiage?
It's hard to get your arms around Bryson DeChambeau on any given day, much less now that he's trying to become Mr. Universe. He looks so completely different, buffed, and you know, just looks. He's taken the Tiger Woods weight room regimen to new heights, and it would appear that he's been able to do so while maintaining enough flexibility to play at a very high level. You know, oftentimes guys that go on these weight training regimens and try and bulk up, they lose their flexibility, they lose some of their fine touch, and they can't play as well as they did. But it appears not to be the case with Bryson. He's at the top of the leaderboard. We'll see if he can hang in there over the next 36 holes this weekend.
Yeah, one of the things that's fascinating about the type of training that he's doing, it's called MAT training, muscle activation technique and training. It's unbelievable, and I think that you're going to start to see more and more people go there. I've actually had a lady who was trained by DeChambeau's trainer, and she's here in Nashville, and it was a very fascinating. I got a chance to witness it and how it's done, and it's probably the future of where sports that need to maintain their flexibility and agility while getting much stronger. I think that's where it's going. So it's going to be fascinating to see how it plays out. But I'm interested because I think that the guys that are one guy at 9 and one guy at 8 are going to be the people we end up watching coming down the home stretch, and that's Justin Thomas and McIlroy. Thomas, pretty disappointing missed cut at Riviera, and Rory, pretty disappointing final round and gets clipped by Adam Scott last week. Talk to us about where you see their games as they head pre-Players Championship talk, and how you like their chances this week.
Well, I like both of their chances. I think you kind of nailed it. They're both playing with a little bit of a chip on their shoulder. this week for different reasons, Roy, because he kind of kicked it away in the final round in Los Angeles last week, and Justin because he wasn't even around on the weekend last week. I think they're both in fine form and moving toward the major season in great shape. Justin Thomas is healthy, which for much of last year he was not. He didn't talk about it a lot, but he had some wrist issues, as I recall. And Rory just looks solid. And, you know, I think one of the key differences that you're seeing with Rory, and it's been commented on in television, he's putting better, generally speaking. And that's kind of been the weak link in an otherwise brilliant golf game. And he's been working with Brad Faxon, arguably one of the best putters and best putter scientists that have ever played the game of golf. And something's clearly clicking there because Rory's putting better than I think he ever has in his entire life.
If he could just not lose strokes putting, he would be winning 5, 6, 7 times a year. You know, that's the thing.
Yeah,
you're right.
Exactly. Yeah.
One of the things that I'm fascinated by, and I want to get your opinion on this because you are in the media and how it would affect you if it would happen to you. Patrick Reed recently, he's had plenty of rules issues, and then Peter Costas comes out this week and says that he has watched him fluff his lie in the fairway multiple times on top of other burning issues that Patrick Reed has going on. And then yesterday, the people at the PGA Tour shot down the question, wouldn't even let the guy finish his question about that statement. What kind of challenge is it for you in the media when there is a story like that and the PGA Tour tries to squish it like a bug? What's your feelings on where this is going? And it does not seem like it's headed anywhere to calming down in the future.
Well, I missed what you're talking about. Was this in a press conference after the round of golf?
Yeah, yesterday.
And the moderator just wouldn't let the question go?
That's right. He would not let it go. And I found it very fascinating. And I just think that the more that Patrick Reed and the Houston Astros run from the truth, the harder it's going to get for both of them. And it just blows my mind that both of them are taking a ridiculous stance, but I could not believe the PGA Tour tapped down and patted down the fire that was brewing off of that Peter Costas comment and the comments between he and Brooks Koepka. I'm fascinated by it. I just didn't know what you thought about how you would handle it if you wanted to ask that question and they just told you, Jim, no, thank you. We don't want your comments here.
Well, that's not surprising. That's how the tour rolls. But really, the responsibility for the fact that this story continues to endure many months after the episode at the Hero Challenge at the end of last year is, in fact, the responsibility of the PGA Tour. One of three things should have happened in that sand trap with Patrick Reed. First of all, he should have called a two-shot penalty on himself, which he didn't. Secondly, before he signed his scorecard, he should have looked at the video and been counseled by the rules officials on the PGA Tour to carefully consider what he was about to sign for. And if he signed for the wrong score, the third outcome should have been that the tour should have disqualified him from the tournament on the spot. None of those three things happened, and as a result, the tour has this mess that they created, and they're just going to have to live with because this story is not going to die. There's going to be other Peter Costases that are going to come out of the woodwork and speak about incidents or episodes that they've seen where Patrick Reed used questionable judgment. And it's unfortunate, but it's a real black eye for a very, very image-conscious organization like the PGA Tour.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. The other highlight for the week is the other PGA Tour event that's going on in Puerto Rico, in the Puerto Rico Open. But what many people feel like out of these young players, maybe the person that's going to win the most majors, Victor Hovland, is tied for the lead with three others, Emiliano Grillo, Josh Teeter, and Kyle Stanley. Victor Hovland is a very interesting kid. He's smart, bright, has a little bit of a biting sense of humor. He's a pretty funny guy. But he seems to have a real high ceiling. Talk to us about what it would mean for him to win the Puerto Rico Open.
You know, he's one of those kids, and this is a bit of a cliche, but I think it's true. When he breaks through and learns how to win, watch out, because this kid's got all the tools, got a great attitude, He won the U.S. Amateur Championship a couple of years back. He's the real deal. He's made a lot of money so far. He just hasn't claimed the winner's circle, but I think he's going to very soon. And you know, I think the first guy that we said this about many, many years ago was David Duval, clearly an emerging talent. And we all thought, boy, if he can figure out how to win, he's going to win a bunch. And he did for a period of time. And I think the same is true of Victor Hovland.
Yeah, I think that this guy is about ready to take, you know, I think Matt Wolf is the highlight reel, because he's got a very unique swing and he kills it and he's got some personality and he's a fun dude. And then Colin Morikawa is as steak and potatoes as you can possibly be, solid in every way, shape, and form, but not overly in your face. And Victor Hovland is like a little bit of a blend between the two and seems to be wired for big time victories. So I'm excited to see where he is going. And the final the final question I had for you is, the Premier Golf League is not dying, but it's dying a slow death. Even I know that you have it called dead on arrival, but it's dying a slow death with McIlroy saying that he's not interested. Tiger probably can't even make that work, but it's still, at least at face value, offering some interest. Is there any new developments in the Premier Golf League, and what's about to happen, or what's your findings on it in the most recent couple of weeks?
Well, there is a little bit of news. Yesterday, the CEO of the organization finally came public and spoke to some media outlets and did a podcast over in England, essentially reaffirming everything that's been reported about it as far as format, schedule, intent, the whole thing. Downplayed Rory's statement this week that he's out because he wants to be on the right side of history. The guy made an interesting argument for why they've been working on this for 6 years. But I just don't, you know, we'll have some reporting in Monday's issue from Charlie Hoffman, who's now on the PAC Players Advisory Council of the PGA Tour, and a very thoughtful guy. And he's not one of the top 48 in the world who might be considered for this. And he said he just doesn't think it's getting any traction. So I think right now it's a lot of noise in the system, and a couple of players are keeping it alive because they're trying to use it for leverage with the tour in some form or fashion. But I don't think anything's really changed. I just don't believe that it's going to get the traction it needs from the best 48 players in the world to ever get off the ground.
I hear you, buddy. How can my listeners get a copy of the Global Golf Post?
You can go to globalgolfpost.com and sign up for a free subscription to our Monday edition, where we'll tell you everything you need to know about what happened in the world of competitive golf last week. And you can also get our new subscription product, GGP Plus, where on a daily basis we deliver original premium quality golf journalism that you can't find anywhere else with no advertising. I think your Nashville listeners would love both of our products.
I'm very sure of that. I forgot we went out slightly out of order. What are the headlines going to read on Monday morning, Nuge?
I think the headline Monday morning is going to say, "An Irishman shines in Mexico."
Nice. Rory McIlroy bringing it home. I like your chances there, sir. We need to get off the losing streak because we're fumbling early in the season, sir.
I think we've got a donut going.
That's exactly right. Have a great weekend, Nuge. I look forward to having you on again next week, buddy.
Cheers, Virgil. Thank you.
When we return, we're headed to the Orca Driving Range, so stick around. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here at 104.5 The Zone.
It's tax refund. Nobody said it was easy.
Welcome back, and you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here at 104.5 The Zone. So this time every Saturday morning, we make the turn and decide it's a better idea to go to the range, the Orca Driving Range, where I bring in the best teachers in the world, and today is no different. Really, in my opinion, his book, The 10 Lessons, The True Fundamentals of the Golf Swing, should actually be adopted by the PGA as the how-to, and I strongly encourage anybody who wants to do a deep dive in what really needs to happen in the golf swing to check out Bob Grissett's book, The 10 Lessons, The True Fundamentals of the Golf Swing, and joining us now from Boca Raton, Florida, Bob Grissett himself. Bob, how are you today, buddy?
Morning, Virg. How you doing? Thank you for the nice plug. That was nice of you.
My pleasure. Well, I mean, it's kind of like a Bible in sorts, because it really does an outstanding job of thoroughly breaking down the integral parts of power and accuracy and how they come together, not separately, which is baffling to a lot of people who play the game, because they feel like they're two separate entities that come together independently and not together, which is really kind of a sad situation. But everybody wants to talk about distance, and we just saw some really interesting stuff from the decade guys with Scott Fawcett and Lou Stagner about both the PGA Tour players and the LPGA Tour players. The top players are noticeably longer than the second tier, third tier, and fourth tier players. Talk to us about creating power that is ubiquitous among everybody. Obviously, there are different golf swings, but the key principles of power.
Well, obviously, the power, being able to hit the ball farther, the first ingredient is solidity of contact. I mean, that's hitting it in the center of the face is without question probably the most important thing. And after that is speed. So the question is, how do you generate speed? And the answer is, if we look at Rory McIlroy as an example, a relatively small guy, 5'11", 170 pounds, and just hits at prodigious distances. And the reason is his hip rotations on the forward swing are faster than any other player on the PGA Tour. So that's where it's at. On the tour today, if you can't hit the ball far, you really can't play. Distance has become probably the most important ingredient in being able to play effectively on the tour today. Brian Gay has worked a lot with my friend Joe Mayo, and he's increased his clubhead speed. He wasn't competitive. So he went from 105 miles an hour average to 115 miles an hour average, which is about 30 yards.
Yeah, and
you create it through ground forces. I mean, there's a lot involved in there. Pressure shift. Rory, in my view, has improved his golf swing probably, other than Justin Rose, more than any other player on the tour. It's a very different golf swing than he had 10 years ago. A lot of people don't see the nuances or the differences, but to me, they're pretty obvious. He's changed his address position. He's bent over more. His shoulder tilts, he works on continuously, which I talk about a lot in my book. And something that doesn't get talked a lot about is on the backswing, he's able to, when you set up to a golf ball, your shoulders are in protraction, meaning they're inward. Now, they have to be, or your arms would be spread way apart. On the backswing, the spine extends, both thoracic and pelvis, and even a little bit cervical. And the way that's achieved is the right shoulder actually retracts, and the arms are allowed to orbit the body. So Rory achieves a lot of his power because he's able to have a very centered pivot, number one. Number two, he has very, very deep hands, meaning his hands are getting well behind him. I think people confuse this with taking the club too far inside. That isn't what he does. I mean, his club, if anything, stays out for a long time. But his right arm gets in an extremely deep position at the top, similar to Snead. A lot of long hitters in the history of golf, Fred Couples, does the same thing, although he elevates his elbow. So I think the deep hand is part of the first ingredient, getting that huge wind-up on the backswing. I call it a stretch. I don't like the word coil because humans are not elastic. But basically, the shoulders are turning in a centered pivot with the hands as deep as they can, and then the downswing is initiated with a lateral shift for these players, and then the hips just unwind like a beast. His hips really go fast. And I think a lot of times when people look at like a Fred Couples, they look at his rhythm and his tempo, but if they were in his body, if you could somehow create a machine that would allow you to feel what he feels, I think people would be shocked about how fast his body moves. The issue is the body can't move except so fast. I mean, obviously, when people think they swing too fast, my comment is always, oh, you hit it too far, which obviously isn't the case. So they're not getting the coordination of their body and their hands and arms together, and that's really key. One of the things, this is a long-winded answer, but one of the things that I work on with a lot of people, Justin Rose works on this all the time, is really being able to create as much speed in your arms initially on the downswing. He works on releasing the fourth and first accumulators. This gets a little complicated. It's in my book. That's part of the linear motion that occurs, because so many people think power is created by jamming the right elbow in. The biggest issue I see with poor players, and even almost every tour player that I work with, is too much secondary axis tilt on the downswing. They're tilting too far to the right too soon. Right elbow's jammed in. The right elbow is a lever, and it has to be released. And I don't want people to confuse that with throwing it from the top, because the butt of the club is always moving towards the golf ball. But that is a really, really important ingredient. I have a great video with Rory practicing that over and over and over again, not making swings, just making rehearsals from the top of the backswing, for those that don't know, which we call P4, and then to P6, where the shaft is parallel to the ground, the downswing. The wrist, if anything, the wrist hinge increased slightly, but the right arm released and the left arm released, meaning the left arm came down across the chest.
Yeah, the guys at AMG really did a great job of describing how so much speed occurs in the hands from 4 to 6. And I really think that you describe that as good as anybody I've ever seen. And I would like to, if you could go into that a little bit about how the hand speed is accumulating and where you feel like most people can gain the most speed there, because that is something that a lot of people would really benefit from.
Okay, so if we go back to The Golfing Machine, Homer Kelly's book, which is for most people impossible to read, but in his book he listed 4 power accumulators, and the power accumulators were the up and down hinging of the right arm, the up and down hinging of the left wrist, and then the rotation that would occur in the forearms and or we could call it supination or pronation that has to occur in order to set the club into a plane. And then the last power accumulator would have been the radius of the left arm, or the left arm loading on the backswing kind of across the chest. So if you think in terms of using a hammer and you were pounding a nail up and down, if you held your arm rigidly straight, you couldn't generate any power. But if you bend your elbow up, you can generate power. If you then hinge your right wrist or cock your right wrist back, and then as you release the hammer, you're releasing the elbow first, and then the last thing you're releasing would be the wrist. So that's sort of what's occurring. On the downswing, Justin Rose would be a perfect example of someone to watch. The last 7 years, he does a rehearsal on the downswing, and it isn't that he's going fast with it, but he's trying to feel those levers release. Another way of explaining it is at the top of your backswing, if your hands were 12 inches from your right shoulder, when people do this wrong, as they come down, the hands stay 12, 12, 12, 12, 12, 12, 12, 12, 12. And what they should be doing is they should be going 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, until they get to P6. But the butt of the club is always moving towards the golf ball on an inclined plane. That's what's key.
Man,
when these arms are releasing, or when that lever is releasing, it's not releasing out away from you. It's releasing towards the golf ball. And this, again, was a drill that Harvey Penick used, this drill continuously. I think that's what the boys from AMG said in their video. They had 2 videos, actually, but one of the videos they talked about Harvey's drill. And this was a big drill with him. And I learned it at an early age from an old golf pro in Northern Virginia. With my better students who tend to axis tilt or tend to shift weight too fast to the left, I work on this continually, where they're doing that rehearsal over and over and over and over again. Mike Shy, who works with Bryson DeChambeau, he has a great video that I have that has a gal that he's working with, and she's using an orange whip but doing the same exact drill, not creating a lot of rotation to begin the downswing, allowing the left arm to move down the chest, the right arm to release, all towards the golf ball. And to do it ultimately with speed. And that's the key. And then, obviously, the hips have to be able to rotate, and then you have to be able to extend on the forward to take the club out of the ground.
Yeah, very true.
Is that how you wanted me to explain it?
Oh, yeah, that was exactly how I wanted you to explain it. And another thing, you know, both Rory and the last person I wanted to talk about is Tiger Woods, and where his golf swing is today. both Tiger in his prime and McIlroy now have what I would call like a heaving start, like everything kind of shifts to the right and then a recenter mid to late backswing. And almost every great, not every one, but almost every great driver of the golf ball has that little lateral bump right, late centering to create an almost like an extra amount of horsepower in the sling. I wanted you to talk about that particular piece and also what you see in Tiger Woods' golf swing. I thought it looked as good as I've seen it in quite some time at Riviera. Although he didn't play well, it looks like it's in pretty good working order.
Let's deal with Rory first and also that. There's no question there's a pressure shift to begin the backswing. And there are a few players that are moving. There's basically two centers of mass. There's a center of mass that's above your sternum and the center of mass that's in your hips. And some players like Henrik Stenson, he's moving both to the right and then recentering. That isn't what Rory does. Rory does not move the upper to the right at all. But he does move the lower, and he does it via the feet. And how he does it is basically how Nicklaus was taught, although Nicklaus lifted his left heel off the ground. Nicklaus's teacher was Jack Grout. Jack learned from Alex J. Morrison, and one of Alex J. Morrison's big things was to roll your ankles. So there's a feeling as you go back that the left ankle, if you watch Rory closely, you'll see his weight goes to the inside of his left foot. He's kind of pushing his left foot and pushing his hips slightly to the right as he's rotating. And that's the pressure shift that he gets. I think the confusing part about that and where we need to talk about it a little bit is the greatest amount of pressure shift is occurring from setup to P2, which is where the shaft is parallel to the ground. There's slightly more pressure shift from P2 to P3, but from P3, which is where the left arm is parallel to the ground on the backswing, but from P3 to P4, the pressure shift begins going back to the left. And if I could use numbers, like I'll use Grant Wade as an example. He's approximately, his pressure shift at address is about 62 left, 38 right. When he gets to P2, it's reversed. When he gets to P3, it's about 70 right and 30 left. When he gets to P4, it's 60 right and 40 left. And when he gets to P5, it's 70 left and 30 right. So these players are creating a recentering or a pressure shift back to the right. And a lot of times, back to the left, I should say, and a lot of times it's done primarily in the hips. But the hips, you can't overdo the hips, because if the hips slide too much, then you're going to get that right axis tilt I talked about earlier, which is death.
Yeah, no
doubt.
But
I would agree, there's no question there's a pressure shift. But so many people confuse that with a weight shift. It isn't a weight shift. Pressure plates don't measure weight. They measure pressure, and they're measuring pressure into the ground. And it starts with the feet. So, I mean, I love watching that move that Rory makes off the golf ball. I think that's one area, but he's really very, very centered the entire backswing, and then he begins his downswing, as we suggested. Off to Tiger for a second. I would agree with you. I think in my mind, he's swinging the best he's ever swung. You know, he withdrew from next week too, so I don't know if there's a little bit of an injury problem or not, but he withdrew from the tournament he was scheduled to play next week, which was the Honda Classic. What's different than him, and he talked about it in the article he just did in Golf Digest, is he's staying more centered. I mean, I'm a big believer in a centered pivot, and that's what the article stipulated, that he does that. The second thing that he's doing, he used to have, obviously we knew he used to drop quite a bit on the downswing when he was going through bad stretches, and his shoulders would stay excessively closed at P6, which would create a path too far to the right. The club face came in square, he'd hit it right. If he tries to square it up, club face comes in square with an excessive path to the right, you're going to hook it. Same thing that Rory did early in his career. Rory can only hit one shot early in his career. And that was a draw or a hook, mm-hmm. And it was usually a big one, 30 or 40 yards. So it's an interesting discussion. I think Tiger has, assuming he stays healthy, he's got a lot of wins left. But I love the rhythm of his swing is better, the tempo is better, the sequencing is better. everything's better. And, you know, when we talked about the shoulder on the downswing, I think this is another thing that people get a little confused about. So where should we be at impact? I mean, ideally at impact, if I could do some numbers, your hips would be approximately 45 degrees open. Your chest would be approximately 30 degrees open, but your shoulders would be square. That confuses some people, but it is very plausible and very true that your shoulders could be relatively square at impact. And I think too many people are confusing chest and shoulders like they confuse weight shift and pressure shift.
Yeah, no doubt. Bob, how can my listeners get in touch with you for an online lesson or come to see you in Boca Raton?
They can call. My business phone is 310-990-4653 or 310-990-GOLF. They can go to my website, www.bobgriffithgolf.com. I've got an incredible online lesson portal. I use WhatsApp, and I use that because I can send multiple videos and at one time. We can do live chats. We could even, some of my tour players will even do live lessons. But it's done very professional. I think the fact that you're not necessarily in person, that's outweighed. As long as they can send me good video, and all that's on my website, how to take the video, that's the key.
Bob, you're the best, buddy. Thank you so much for providing such amazing information. And I look forward to having you
Thanks
on again really soon, buddy.
Always good to talk to you. Can't wait till the next time. Best of luck with your new adventure, too.
Thank you very much. All right, when we return, we're going to finish strong. So stick around. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. Time to finish strong, and you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. Last week, Adam Scott got back in the winner's circle for the first time in over 3 years with a pretty profound victory at Riviera. The golf course proved to be the ultimate victor, and it was an amazing final round with the golf course being set up so firm and fast and the pin placements being just right. But there's a lot to take away from what Adam Scott has done when it comes to your golf game and or your life. And about 5 years ago when they banned the long putter, his career was kind of reemerging because he had kind of lost his putter. And the long putter helped him regain some of his skill. And then when they took that away, he and Webb Simpson and Keegan Bradley all disappeared. But he has recommitted himself to the keys to that. And now although he's not, certainly not Brad Faxon or Tiger Woods or Jack Nicklaus, he's not giving away strokes with a putter, and he's still one of the greatest ball strikers in the world. And we got a chance to witness what happens when you don't waste strokes and you have the ability to hit the golf ball like Adam Scott. The perseverance piece that he demonstrates, not giving up and understanding that, you know, God blessed him with a ton of golf swing talent and has forced him to work harder on his putting, is eerily similar to all the facets of our life. And I just think that every once in a while when something occurs that allows you to experience witnessing perseverance and resiliency and adaptability, it's always good to take a piece off of it and put it in your front pocket and make yourself better tomorrow. So for that, thank you for making us part of your Saturday morning, because without you, there is no Talking Golf. For my incredible guest list today of Tammy Matheny, Jim Nugent, and Bob Grissett, thank you for joining me. We'll see you more Talking Golf next week. Have a great day.